Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order, February 6, 2020. With me today is Senator Bishop, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, and we've been joined by Senate President Geisel. Senator Von Imhoff will not be joining us today, along with Senator Wilson. They both have other matters to address. And we have also, Senator Hoffman has joined us. We have one item on the agenda today, and that's the supplemental budget to deal with the current fiscal year we're in. We have several members from the different departments here to help the committee understand the supplemental request. And we have a presentation from the Office of Management and Budget that will take us through the supplemental, which is significant by any measure in real dollars or historically. And in particular, it's significant with our depleted cash reserves that the committee has been struggling with. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and ask the director of the Office of Management and Budget to come forward, Mr. Steininger. He will take us through this presentation. I see he has several lifelines behind him. So if we ask him a question and he wants a little assistance, we can signal the chairman and we'll let him get some assistance so we can have the most accurate information. And we may even want to have some discussions with some of the department heads that are here, depending on the item and the interest and concerns of committee members. Go ahead and take us through the presentation, please.
For the record, Neil Sanger, Director, Office of Management and Budget. And I'd just like to thank the room full of subject matter experts here to help me out with answering questions. So the supplemental budget that was introduced yesterday is split into two parts. We have one section which are items related to emergency response and also items of a urgent nature where the cash needs of the program mean that without a supplemental being passed in the near future, there will be not enough funds to continue those programs. There's also what we're considering to be regular supplemental items. Those are items that are still sufficiently urgent as to require a FY20 effective date in the appropriation, but not so urgent that they need action right now to continue those programs. They have a little bit more breathing room within their current budget, but still need additional money to complete the fiscal year. The total of those urgent items is $241.9 million in unrestricted general funds. The regular items total $20,600,000 in unrestricted general funds. When you include federal revenues and other fund sources, the total of all the supplemental items is $507.9 million.
Senator Hoffman, do you have a question?
I have a question. I did a cursory review of your supplemental, and since you mentioned things that are urgent to the people of Alaska, I don't see any funds being requested by this administration other than donations from the people of Alaska to get Real ID. And I think that the people that are going to be most affected by the lack of Real ID and the ability to travel are the elderly and the sick. And those are the people that don't even have driver's license. So I'm wondering why there has been no request for what I believe is a life and death situation for people that may need medical attention that don't have Real ID, and the Department of Administration requesting money for Real ID in a life and death situation. I wonder if you could respond to that and why that is not being requested.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I don't know if I can speak to why that's not being requested. What I can speak to is that in the bill there is a small amount of money of DMV receipts related to Real ID, related to document processing. I don't know if I can speak to the needs that you've asked about.
Well, the follow-up, I think, is that it is a life and death situation. And if there is nothing more urgent for the people of Alaska is to ensure that they get medical attention and without real ID. And I think Senator Olson has brought this up on numerous occasions, and maybe Senator Olson would like to follow up. When we're talking about basic life and death situations, I don't know what rises to a more higher standard than that, and hopefully we can address that before this this supplemental is finally passed by this body, because the measure that I'm going to have on all of the requests is, does that do those requests rise to a higher level than a life and death situation for people that are living in Tututuliak, Eek, Ekwok, any place in Alaska, when they are not able to travel from their community because they don't have real ID, and the administration is asking the people, the poorest people of Alaska, to come up with funds to donate to the administration so they can go out there and assist them with real ID. It's absurd. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steininger, I certainly echo the previous comments by the senator from Bethel, who's concentrating on his people, Tuntutuliak. I want to talk about the people in Shishmaref and Savunga and Shaktulik, because what's really troubling is under number 15, I'm seeing $500,000 has been put forward to go ahead and move a DMV site within Anchorage. And where is the concern about all those people that are out there, which, and I've had a discussion with the commissioner about alternative IDs out there, but they're not available to everybody. I'm looking at what the concentration of priorities is with this supplemental budget has to do with more with moving a DMV across town than there is to try and get the equipment or the personnel out to some of these places that have voiced interest in trying to go ahead and make a real ID presence there. And I guess I want to know what the thought process is with this kind of a budget that you are standing behind and trying to defend.
I think on that one, there's a reference of a future slide, slide 15, and we're on slide 2. So if you could have maybe a preliminary answer to Senator Olson's question, and then we can come back in more detail on that subject matter on slide 15.
I think I'd rather do that, Mr. Chairman. We get that appropriate slide up in place, and then we can let our feelings known then.
Yes. Do you have any comments or part of an answer to Senator Olson's question before we speed on to bring this back up on maybe slide 15?
Chair Stedman, I think we can discuss that when we get to slide 15, and we might bring up a representative from the department to discuss, you know, what built to their supplemental needs.
Sure. Yeah. Senator Olson, you can help the chairman remember to pause on slide 15.
Don't worry, you'll be adequately warned, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
So this slide is giving some context to the total budget numbers, inclusive of supplementals. So you can see that first bar is the fiscal year 2019 budget, inclusive of supplementals passed. You have the FY 2020 budget with the supplementals that we've proposed to date, and then the FY 21 governor's budget. So you can see from 19 to 20 inclusive supplementals, there's still a significant reduction in the total UGF spending of about $239 million. From 20 to 21, when you include supplementals, there's a reduction of about $70 million. In proposed spending.
I think there's some issues that we have not dealt with in FY20 in the supplemental, one of which Senator Hoffman and Senator Olson brought up. But we also have oil tax credits that we're trying to struggle with. we may be impacted upwards around $100 million, my understanding, if the court is not, if the state does not prevail in the litigation dealing with the issuance of bonds. So has the department have any position on that yet, OMB, on dealing with that subject matter, or is it to come later in the session so we know what action we're going to take, either through a direct appropriation or through those bond issuance?
Chair Stedman, we're hoping that with some time there will be more clarity on the outcome of that lawsuit so that we can, you know, put forward a proposal based on that outcome, although we are discussing how to address that.
Yeah. So it looks to me like if we are in a position where we have to do an appropriation, we will be at or above, the appropriation for the bonds, for not issuing the bonds. If we have to do a direct appropriation from GF, we're going to be above the FY19 plus supplementals. Year on year, we'll actually be flat or higher in expenditures. Is that not correct?
Chair Stedman, I don't have the exact number. You know, it doesn't come to mind right now, but it would increase the amount of UGF need if we had to pay out the pay out those credits.
And the point I want the public to recognize is that there's been a lot of effort put into reduction of the operating budget by both the administration and the legislature in the last year. And when we add back our supplemental request for this year's current budget, and we deal with the tax credit issue, we are flat or higher than last year's spending. And if we issue bonds, there will be some reduction from the previous year, but we'll be impacting cash flows going forward, possibly $50 million a year for several years. So the large step down in operating expenditures did not materialize. And it are going to be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to deliver in the budget coming at us, the FY21. I think that's a very important point, because we spent some time last year, quite a bit of time at this table, with these very same members, talking about not having supplemental budget requests, that we wanted our budget as passed by the legislature and enacted by the governor to be as accurate as possible to minimize the supplemental. And we have, as reflected in the table today, a colossal size supplemental in front of us, which I think gives the public the impression that one, during the process, we can reduce the operating budget, but then at the end of the day, 6 months later, we add it all back in. So it's an issue the committee is struggling with, how we're going to deal with the upcoming FY21 process. Go ahead and continue.
So the items that we've highlighted in the first section of the bill that are considered to be urgent or emergency response items are detailed on this slide. $110.5 million of that is for fire suppression. So this is money that has both already been spent, as well as $16 million for a projection for the amount that we believe will be spent on fighting spring fires during fiscal year 20. In the Department of Transportation, there's $158,000 related to the Dalton Highway Antigum Pass. At the Nick Goose Bay Road, there's a $2 million reappropriation. Really, it's a scope change for a project that was directed towards a very specific section of the road. We've introduced a scope change to remove that restriction so that the money can be used for rut repairs elsewhere on the road. There's $3 million of costs that we've spent already for relief for the earthquake, which after spending them, we found were ineligible for federal reimbursement. These are costs to repair roadways. In the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, there's $900,000 for the mass notification system. It's a reappropriation. The slide says UGF, however, after we produced this slide, we realized it's actually it's a typo. It's $450,000 in UGF, $450,000 in federal matching funds. In the Department of Health and Social Services, the Medicaid program has a supplemental need of $128.3 million in UGF, which brings in $162.1 million in federal receipts. We have a couple slides following this slide that go into detail, you know, how we got into the position of requiring such a large supplemental for Medicaid services.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The $110,500,000 for fire suppression, was any of that for Swan Lake fire?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I don't know that I can speak to exactly which fires that goes towards. It's for all the fire suppression for fires on state lands.
Okay. And that was, if I could, Mr. Chair, that's sort of what I was getting at. Because the feds made a decision to let that fire run, and that was turned out to be a horrific decision. And I'm just curious to the extent at which we're paying for the sort of negligence irresponsible action of the federal government.
Sounds like more of a DNR question, but I think that is an issue that is a concern.
Let me see if there's...
Hi, for the record, my name is Chris Mache. I'm the State Forester and Division Director for the Division of Forestry. And through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, to answer your question more specifically, the supplemental does not include any of the costs for the Swan Lake fire. That's covered under what we call our federal authority portion of our fire cost accounting, and that's a separate from the GF piece. But to answer your question more specifically, the state will be reimbursed for the full $49 million that was spent in federal authority to fight that fire.
So just on that reimbursement, is that factored into this supplemental budget somehow, or do we have a positive $49 million coming in somewhere accounted for, maybe for OMB or for you, Chris?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. No, that's a separate accounting. The federal authority piece of the budget is authority to collect federal revenue and also spend general fund to suppress those fires that are in our service area. The way firefighting works in the state, the Alaska Fire Service, which is the main federal agency that does fire suppression, protects a certain area of the state. We protect another area. When we fight a federal fire in our service area, we spend general fund money up front and get reimbursed, and they're doing the same thing in their service area. They're spending federal money on state lands and then get reimbursed, and that's called the cross-billing process, and that process takes approximately 24 months to straighten out. So those payments will not affect this. This is purely cost for state, private, and municipal lands, which by statute we are charged with protecting.
Follow up again?
Just a clarification. So at some point in time, though, we will be receiving $49 million from the federal government, and that will be reflected in a future budget. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, at some future point, we will be reimbursed that full amount, and it goes to the general fund.
Thank you.
Maybe OMB can help us with the accounting of that. If it's a 24-month delay, and we can take a look at those particular accounts so the committee members can see what is owed the state beyond just the immediate fires last year, if there's anything out, you know, 20 months back or what have you. So it's clear to committee members how the accounting process works and the budget and the impacts on the budget. So if OMB could help the committee with that, it'd be appreciated. If not, we'll have Ledge Finance do it, so it's clear to the committee members. Senator Olson, you had a question?
No, actually.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski asked my questions, and Mr. Mache did a good job. Just one last time, the $110,500 UGF, that's gone. There's no cross billing that'll come back and supplement this.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes, that is money that has been spent. The one caveat I will add to that is three of the fires this year were considered what we call FMAG fires. That's a fire mitigation assistance grant through FEMA that we can apply for certain fires that meet that criteria, usually very dangerous fires that are threatening large urban areas. We do expect that through that process, which is again lengthy, can be up to 24 or more months to collect, we'll probably return approximately $30 million to the Treasury. That money probably will not show up until FY 21 and 22 through the billing and collection process. Those fires are audited very extensively by FEMA, and it takes a long time. We have to provide all the backup. They look at almost every invoice to make sure it's eligible. And for eligible expenses, they will reimburse the state 75% during the eligibility period.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you, I don't know if this question can be answered, but do you know how much of the $110 million was spent to save property?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I wouldn't have to say that the whole $110 million was spent to protect life and property. The majority of those costs were for several large project fires, the Swan Lake fire. Well, excuse me, that was all federal authority. This would have been made mainly up in Fairbanks for the fire that threatened that location and a lot of the fires that were in rural parts of the state, as well as the McKinley fire, which was the one where we had significant loss of structures, the Malaspina fire, many of the valleys, fires that were up in the valley in late August.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have another follow-up by Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. My understanding is that many, if not most, of the fires were caused, were human-caused by companies or people. Is there, are there efforts underway to try to recover for, against the people or organizations that caused the fires?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, there were a lot of, we have a lot of human fires, human-caused fires every year. We do investigations on all of those to determine whether there's any negligence, and if there is negligence, whether there's any recoverable funds that we can secure to cover the suppression costs. Typically, those are insurance proceeds, either homeowners or business policies, and we probably have right now four different cases moving through the civil process to recover funds. And again, that's a lengthy time frame. 7 years is the statute of limitations. Because of the workload at law, a lot of the cases don't get started until 5 to 6 years from the initial event. So short answer is yes.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
Thank you. The FY20 budget for the Medicaid program was built on ambitious goals by the department for savings initiatives. Relayed to a lot of items that they believed at that time to be either optional services or places where they can make reductions to the program. Starting the development process of that budget, there is projected about $20 million shortfall just from the FY19 budget moving into 20. So the need for the program as it was projected in November of 2018 was about $683 million. Through the legislative process, that budget was reduced to $574.6 million. Then through further vetoes, that was reduced to $516.3. You can see on this slide a handful of the areas where the department was, you know, looking at during that time period to save that money and to bring the cost of that program down, including reducing provider payments, withholding inflation adjustments, you know, elimination of services that they sought at that time to be optional. And that's how they got to that $516.3 million spend projection that they had. Next slide.
Well, let's stop there for a minute. Back up to that other slide. I'm a little confused on the bar on the left. Explain that again, this projected shortfall. And I understand what the conference committee number is. For those watching at home, that's the budget that that the House and the Senate put together collectively and put on the governor's desk. And then the column on the right, post-veto, is after the governor signs it, is my understanding of these two columns. But explain to me again what this first column is.
Yes, Chair Steadman. So the first column, the blue bar, represents what the base budget for Medicaid would be. That would be the FY19 budget, which is what we base kind of our starting point for building the FY20 budget. The orange portion of that bar represents a shortfall in that budget that the department was projecting for FY20. So on November 30th of 2018, you know, as we came in and started looking at building the FY20 budget, the department was projecting that the general fund need for the Medicaid program in fiscal year 20 would be $683 million. That was reflected in the initial budget proposals at that time, prior to the governor amended budget, after we had started looking with the department at ways to reduce that spend. So that was the projection, you know, kind of the status quo Medicaid projection at the time we started building the FY20 budget. So this is just to give context for what those, the true scale of the spending reduction goal that the department had going into FY20, and how that budget was built over that time.
We don't have the full committee here, but we got most of the committee members. I don't recall the whole projected shortfall orange bar. So it's a little concerning. So kind of jumping ahead and kind of out of order, but, and we haven't even started our process yet this year. Should the committee then be on the lookout for another orange bar issue for the FY21 budget?
Chair Stedman, I guess you can consider our supplemental request this year to be the orange bar for FY20, because that supplemental budget request is what our anticipated shortfall in the Medicaid program is today.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
So with those ambitious savings goals, you know, the department ran into a lot of difficulty in actually achieving those savings. Some of the services that they sought to be optional at the time that the budget was built turned out to not actually be truly optional services once they started working with their federal partners and other stakeholders. But when you do look at what the total projected spend for FY20 is, inclusive of the $128 million supplemental need, they're still saving about $38 million from what that status quo projection was. So while there were a lot of failures in implementation of savings goals, it wasn't universally failures. There were a lot of successes. $38.4 million reduction is still a very significant savings over what the status quo was. So I think that point can get lost when you look at a supplemental need as large as $128 million.
So, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it was this committee that identified the tribal claims and pursued that avenue with the cooperation of the tribes in the state of Alaska. And I would like to note that over 50% of the savings that are proposed or reported on this page are contributed to the tribal members of the state of Alaska.
And Senator Hoffman, as I recall, the committee's been concerned about that and urging that action for several years.
That's correct.
So it is concerning our inability to control Medicaid. And I don't know what we're going to do here yet. We haven't started that process for the upcoming budget, but it is rather alarming and discomforting that we do budget reductions, significant budget reductions, and we just add them back 6 months later for whatever reason. It makes it more difficult for the public to understand the significant difficulty we have in dealing with our reducing the operating budget as our cash runs out. Senator Bishop.
Just a quick comment, and Mr. Steininger, it does say projected savings of $38 million, so that's not a given yet, right?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes, that's correct. We're still in fiscal year 20, so this is based on projections today.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What would be the impact to the state or to the Medicaid services if the legislature didn't add back the $128 million to Medicaid.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, if I may move to my next slide, that does a good job of illustrating what that impact would be.
Okay, before you do that, let's see if there's any other questions on this slide. Okay, go ahead and continue then with the next slide and then wrap in your presentation some assistance for Senator Wilikowski's question.
So on this slide, you can see the blue line shows the cash flow in the Medicaid program with the current funding level. You can see that slide, that line hits $0 around the end of March. So the implication there is without a supplemental appropriation, we'll no longer be able to pay out to service providers at the end of March, beginning of April. With the supplemental that gives us the injection of an additional appropriation that allows them to finish out the fiscal year. Their average weekly spend that they're projecting for the rest of the year is about $13.8 million in UGF. And that last point on this slide, insufficient funding to get through the last quarter of FY 2020, is a fairly optimistic statement. Really, there's insufficient funding to guarantee we get through the third quarter of FY 2020.
Maybe take the opportunity to explain what the formula-driven program mechanism kind of works like, where because we don't have the ability to appropriate X amount of dollars and stick with our budget till the end, we end up getting a bill sent to us. So help the public understand why this goes to zero and we can't just leave it at zero.
Chair Stebbins, so the Medicaid program, you have beneficiaries in the state. About 35% of the state are beneficiaries of the Medicaid program. As those beneficiaries utilize the services that they're granted through the Medicaid program, the state is obligated to pay those service providers for the services rendered. Even if the appropriation is less than that cost, we still have the obligation to reimburse those service providers. We don't, we don't have a choice in that matter. What the department has been doing is working with, the different stakeholders to look at different ways to either reduce those costs or look at the different services that are provided by the program. But those sorts of changes to the program require a lot of coordination between a lot of outside parties, and the federal government provides over 70% of the funding for this program, so they have a lot of say in the services provided under this program.
So it's a nice way to say we're under federal law.
Yes.
We can't avoid it. But we will, I think, the committee will be very concerned when we put together the upcoming budget that we avoid what's going on here at the table today and have more realistic numbers in the budget documents, no matter how ugly it looks. And we can't identify and fix problems unless we can delineate and define them more accurately. So, and I recognize you're a new OMB director, because the last OMB director made the commitments, not you. So I understand that some of these comments are more in a historical perspective. So you'll have your opportunity 1 year from now. Can I go ahead and continue?
This next slide is an update from a slide that I included in my general FY21 budget overview. It's been updated to add all fund sources to show Medicaid historical spending, and it does a good job of illustrating the growth in the program, and also to the point you just made, you can see here that we're not projecting into FY21 significant reductions. Rather, we'd like to come back to you with more savings, but once those savings can actually be realized, rather than kind of projecting savings that we can't guarantee.
I think the committee would appreciate that. It also gives us a more refined estimate of how long our cash position will last also. And I'll, just as a note to the public, when we go through our budgetary process here at the table, we will be working with the department trying to identify cost savings. So we're going to do what we can to look for cost savings and also have discussions on what formula-driven mechanisms can be altered to stay within federal requirements and get these costs under control. So I just don't want the public to think we're going to do nothing and let it just run hog wild. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to request the growth on beneficiaries from 2015 to 2020. Where in the state has that growth taken place? I wonder if you could have that provided to this committee or to my office. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think what we'll do is we'll ask him, Senator Hoffman, to go ahead and do a geographical distribution of the beneficiaries and the beneficiarial growth so we can get the marginal difference and package that up for the Finance Committee. I'll ensure that Senator Von Imhoff, who's going to be, or is the subcommittee chairman for this particular issue, and she can integrate it into her discussions, and we'll get it to all members also, because we'll have it back to the full committee. And I'd also like to have that backed up a few more years before the growth started in 15 as a kind of a separate data set, so we can see what it looked like back in the early part of the century, the first decade, versus the last several years, as Senator Hoffman has requested. So that'll be good information for the subcommittee to work with. Any other questions on the growth of this? Thank you. Go on to the next one.
So the next section of the presentation is addressing what we're referring to as the regular supplemental items. These are items that are still sufficiently urgent to require an appropriation in FY20, but not so urgent that they need to be addressed immediately. So there's also some items within this that just for technical reasons have a supplemental effective date and are part of this bill. In the Department of Administration, there's $1.7 million for caseload growth and operational costs in the Office of Public Advocacy. And in the Division of Motor Vehicles, there's $50,000 for document security and preservation systems related to documents brought in for Real ID, and $500,000 for a office location move. The rent at the Anchorage office of the DMV was significantly increased, so they are moving to a new location to avoid a large rent increase, but that does cost some money for build out of that new space.
Is that relocation into state-owned facilities, or is it privately held?
Chair Stemmen, I believe the new facility is owned by the University of Anchorage, or the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Okay. Questions on this slide? The next slide, please.
In the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, there's a grant from the Housing and Urban Development. It's a community development block grant related to disaster recovery. One thing to note, there's a typo on this slide. It should be $35.8 million of federal receipt authority. There's also an update to the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska Impact Grant Program, adding about $6.7 million of federal authority to update that number to what the revenue for that program is.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is additional royalties that has came in past the budget that we passed earlier this year. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's correct.
Thank you.
I think this will get wrapped up into our capital budget and a few other items here at the table. So. Okay, next slide, please.
In the Department of Corrections, we've added carry-forward language related to federal mandate collections. These are collections of revenue for housing of federal inmates at state facilities. The amount is set on a per-day cost for those inmates. There's been some additional revenue from those collections over time, and the department is adding language to be able to access those prior collections in order to avoid a general fund supplemental need to address population management issues. Also, we've added language to extend the lapse date for the Palmer Correctional Center appropriation made in FY20. The amount of time it's going to take to reopen the Palmer facility is in the 12 to 18 months range, and so that's going to extend into the next fiscal year. And so we just need to extend the lapse date on that appropriation so that they can continue that activity.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What sort of efforts does the Corrections Department expect to undertake to start recruiting correction officers? You're going to have to hire dozens of correction officers. It's going to take some time. And I've heard concerns that that process should be starting now as opposed to waiting. Are you aware of the process that's being taken to get correction officers there?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I think I'd like to bring somebody from the department up to address those recruitment issues. I do know that, you know, recruitment and retention of correctional officers, you know, amongst other job classes in the state is an issue being addressed.
Yeah. We have a lifeline coming. I'll have a brief at ease while we... The awesome powers of the chairman, we're going to allow the OMB director to have unlimited lifelines today for his request.
Thank you.
That'll make the answers as accurate as possible. So go ahead and help Senator Wilkowski with that question. I think he'll be working on this issue going forward anyway, so it'll help spin the committee up.
To the committee, my name is April Wilkerson, and I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. I also have Acting Deputy Commissioner Jennifer Winkleman to help on the policy. Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, if you could repeat the question.
Thank you. Just if I could, Mr. Chair, the recruitment that's being taken to hire correction officers for the Palmer Correctional Center.
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, we do believe that it's going to take anywhere from 12 to 18 months to bring the facility up and operational. Our current process for recruitment of correctional officers only is between 8 to 12 weeks. We do feel that given the timeline to bring the facility up and operational to a housing capacity, that we do have sufficient time to not only meet our current recruitment vacancies of about 90 officers, but then to address the officer needs that would be associated with the Palmer facility.
You have a follow-up? No? Okay, thank you. And then we'll have more questions and more work done on this, you know, when we go through the subcommittee process, because the corrections is not quite as big as the challenge is Medicaid, but it's on the radar screen for the magnitude of the impact of the budget. Go ahead and continue, Mr. Steininger.
In the Department of Education and Early Development, there's $10 million in additional federal receipt authority. This is to allow us to obligate federal receipts to send out to school districts around the state. These are pass-through grants. There's also $100,000 of UGF and $150,000 of receipt authority for operations and maintenance of the Mount Edgecombe Aquatic Center.
You have any questions on this slide? Chairman, Senator Olson.
one of the concerns we have from my district, which is rural Alaska, obviously, is that the lack of swimming or training for teaching kids, especially children, how to swim are out there. How much of this money is going to be dedicated toward the swimming pool that is there for some of the students that do come from rural Alaska to get their high school education? Or is there any money for the to get the pool up and running? Because it seems to be one of those things we keep hearing about, but it's every time I check into it and have questions about it, it always seems to have, well, they got this, they got that problem, and the lack of funding. And so what happens is that during the summertime, we have all these drownings out there, especially of children and boating accidents.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the Mount Edgecombe Aquatic Center is currently operating for the purpose of instruction of the students. We continued operating it during the fall semester. This money is to ensure that we continue to operate it here into the spring semester for classes for the students of Mount Edgecombe to ensure that they learn to swim. The $100,000 is to ensure that the operation of that pool doesn't come at the expense of other instructional needs within the Mount Edgecombe High School.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. So if I call my students that are out from Diomede down there to Mount Edgecombe to get their high school diploma and say, when was your last swimming lesson? They can say, maybe yesterday? I mean, is it that up to date?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, assuming they were enrolled in a swimming course, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I got a couple of questions and concerns. We're going to have a full-blown hearing on this bond package coming. I just haven't set the date yet. But I have had staff pass out the 2010 bond package, all of the projects in it, all eight of them. And where you see the dollars being spent from FY14 through FY21 in the estimated or the proposed budget, those are operating funds. And the concern that I have is seven of the eight projects have been built and funded without much discussion within the legislature. These were all voted on by the people to construct and operate. The one project, Mount Edgecombe High School, was the last project to be built. It had an appropriation. For those watching at home, the total numbers we're dealing with is $38 million, and I'm going to round them off. $38 million in operating funds from FY14 through the proposed 21 budget. Of that $38.1 million, I'll just use $38, $500 was put into the Aquatic Center in FY18. There was $400,000 redirected from Uni Match and $100,000 in other funds to total that $500. Of that $500, a significant portion, and we'll lay that out in future meetings, was expensed on maintenance of a brand new facility through DOT public facilities. And that was, we've been working on that issue. The FY19 is $250,000 of receipt authority. And receipt authority isn't cash. And the pool wasn't quite in operation at that time due to some mechanical issues through the construction. So that was receipt authority. In the FY20 budget, there was nothing enacted for that facility, and $5.2 million in the other projects. So what we got laying on the middle of the table here is an urban-rural issue. The rural gets virtually zero, and urban projects get funded with no discussion at all. Then, in the current budget, we've got $650,000 in receipt authority. So we need to work on that issue, and we are working on that with the administration and Department of Education to rectify that. Receipt authority allows the Mount Edgecombe Aquatic Center to reduce the subsidy needed to run the facility. Otherwise, the facility is run for the kids at Mount Edgecombe, which it's built for, and then we have to absorb whatever deficit issue the facility faces. So in order to minimize that and minimize budget impacts, we want to collect revenue at the door, of which the removal of the receipt authority blocked the facility from receiving a check in excess of $100,000 and put considerable disruption in the marketing of that facility to entities that would gladly write the state a check for using that facility when it's not needed for the pool, and then that is out for the kids, and that is outside of the state troopers and outside of the U.S. Coast Guard, which have storage areas so that facility can be used as a training center, again, to help reduce the subsidy. So we have continued work to do coming. I just thought it would be nice for the committee members to actually see the numerics, because I've seen a lot of discussion of this facility, of the projects and where the funding is going to and where the discussion is. And for those watching at home, I apologize, we don't have that on the screen, and it'll be coming in a future hearing on just the bond package. And I think this also affects the ability and interest of future bond packages, particularly from rural legislators, if this is how we're going to be treated. As an example, I'll list off the projects: the State Library Archives and Museums, the Valley Center for the Arts and Learning at the Matsu Campus, Community Arena and Athletic Facility at UA Anchorage, Life Science Classroom and Lab at the University of Fairbanks, Student Housing in the Kenai Campus, Career and Technical Education Center in the Kenai Campus, and another one that's kind of in the rural area, and that's the ADF&G, Alaska Department Fish and Game Near Island Research Facility. That's actually Kodiak Arena. It's a smaller portion, $2.8 million of the $38 million, and then the Aquatic Center. And I'd just like to remind the public and the administration that these projects were voted on by the people of the state of Alaska to build and operate. And we, as referenced by Senator Hoffman, are the appropriators. Yesterday he had to remind the University of Alaska. The legislature isn't chopped liver. We're actually the appropriators. And our job is to ensure as fair as possible distribution of the largesse of the treasury of the state owned by everybody to facilitate everybody's equal interests around the state. So I recognize and appreciate the $100,000 of cash to the Aquatic Center, because the school has been cannibalizing books and pencils for the kids to keep that facility open, so that we'll be in the fast track, however fast the fast track is, because it's urgently needed. And the $150,000 of receipt authority, I don't know if they need the entire amount, but I'd rather have a little extra, because they can get people in the door and start charging for the space. But they have missed the significant portion of the high revenue time of the year without the ability to collect the cash at the door, which we need to work on. So we will go forward with this and work to treat everybody the same. Senator Hoffman, I think your children in your district.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've reminded me of that several times. And the region of the state that has the largest participation in Mount Edgecombe is from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. And it does not go unnoticed to me that the largest area that has the highest drowning rate is from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region. So for me, this issue is a health, life, safety issue, and the other seven that the chairman had noted, a museum, for the first one, arts for the second appropriation, athletic facility for the third, classrooms for the fourth, housing for the fifth, education center for the sixth, and a research facility for the seventh. It's hard for me to compare those appropriations, even though I supported them, to the standard of health, life, safety that has been, I hate to say the word, ignored by previous administrations and this administration. So instead of having this corrected by this committee, I would request the administration to come forward with a number that they feel is adequate to address the health, life, safety of the people of Alaska in Senator Olson district, Senator my district, and there are other areas of the state that are participating in this program. And because it is a health, life, safety issue, I think that the Mount Edgecombe facility should make swimming a mandatory program and not an optional program. That is a separate issue. But I raise this health, life, safety issue as I did in the beginning of the committee when I was addressing the lack of requests by the Department of Administration to address Real ID that's going to result in health, life, safety issue and potential deaths of people that, from the older ages of Alaska's population, because we are not addressing that issue along with this one. When it comes to health, life, safety, I believe that those should rise to the top of the list of this administration. That was pointed out by the chairman of the first seven, and it should not be. It was voted on by the people. The implementation should be fully supported by this administration, and hopefully they will come forward to address those two issues, at least these two issues that have come forward on a health, life, safety priority that should rise to the top of the list, the concerns of the people of the state of Alaska that we as a committee should be addressing and this administration should be addressing as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
I don't want people to forget, we'll leave out the Yukon, Porcupine, Black River, and Koyukuk that I represent in rural Alaska. And I got letters from students just as late as a week ago from Mount Edgecombe, Mr. Chairman. I just want to work with the chair to make sure that this pool gets enough DGF funds to execute long-term contracts with the people that you've mentioned outside the kids at the school to help support the school. That was very well said by you, and I think hopefully the administration got the memo.
Any other questions on this line? We'll take up the suggestion by Senator Hoffman and ask OMB to come forward with solutions or not when they come forward in the upcoming presentation when we go through the bond package. We're going to go through all the projects and try to treat everybody equal. And I just want to assure you that that the committee will not look in arrears and ask for equity. We're looking for equity today going forward. So, go ahead and continue.
In the Office of the Governor, there's $18,000 related to holding public hearings for voter initiatives. There's also $215,000 related to the review, certification, and translation of those voter initiatives. We also have a $3.7 million capital project coming out of the election fund for the Help America Vote Act. This is for more secure voting equipment.
Senator Walkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Just curious about the $215,400 for the initiative review and certification. My understanding is the initiative is reviewed by the Lieutenant Governor and also by the Attorney General. It's done in-house, to my understanding. So I'm at a loss as to where that $215,400 went to, but maybe somebody could explain that.
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, there's also costs related to translation into different languages for the ballots, and you know, review and certification. You know, while they're done in the governor's office, they do cost money.
If I could get a breakdown on those costs, and the election's not till next year, so but maybe they've got to be printed this year. I don't know, but yeah, I'd be curious about the breakdown. This is a supplemental budget for this fiscal year, which ends June 30th. And then the other question I had, Mr. Chairman, and perhaps somebody can just provide this in writing, but I am interested in the voter initiative public hearings, the $18,000, the plan for those hearings, when they'll be, where they'll be, and what the format will be.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I think we can get back to you with that information.
Let's get back to the committee on the, I guess, the compilation of that numeric, and that'll be fine. Other questions? Slide. Okay, next slide, please.
In the Department of Health and Social Services, there's $1 million for the payment assistance program at the Alaska Pioneer Homes. As they've implemented the new rates, you know, they get new information about the financial means of the residents, and an additional $1 million is needed to ensure that no seniors are kicked out of those homes and that anyone that needs assistance receives assistance. At the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, there's $6 million of a sortie to achieve full capacity within that facility. In the Adult Public Assistance Program, there's $8.6 million. This is restoration of a cut to that maintenance of effort that was made in the 20 budget. In reviewing that change to the maintenance of effort calculation with the federal government, we found other changes in the way calculations have been performed in the past, and it made the effect of that change too onerous on those people, so we've decided not to move forward with that plan, and so that sortie is needed to be added back into the budget.
Any other questions? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. On the API, $6 million increment, is any of that money going to WellPath?
With the permission of the chair, I'd like to call forward a representative of the department to discuss that in more detail.
If you could introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and then help OMB with the response to Senator Wilkowski's question, please.
For the record, my name is Santa Eford. I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, some of this money is for continuation of the WellPath contract. It was renewed. The original contract began in February last year. We did renew it again for this coming fiscal year to help with the stabilization of API. I'm happy to say that of all of the findings that API was under, we have actually now resolved 92% of those findings, but we are continuing to contract with WellPath. The current contract ends March 31st with an option to renew that.
Follow up?
Yeah, I'd be interested in getting the breakdown on where that $6 million is going. And is it projected to go to increased nurses or assistants, or is it going to predominantly to the WellPath organization?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, there are a number of things. It is WellPath contract. It is an increase in salaries for the nurses through the nurses studies that were done. It is also having to contract for locum tenens when we cannot hire psychiatrists or other medical personnel that unfortunately cost more. We are continuing to try to recruit to hire staff, but we have to meet the needs of the patients that are in there, so we do have to contract with locum tenens. There is an additional cost in here for continuation of a security contract due to some of the acuity of the patients that are at the hospital. So there are a number of different circumstances that have led up to the $6 million supplemental.
And if you can get back to the committee on the breakdown of that, it would be appreciated. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Eford, can you just tell me that WellPath does not employ these nurses?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the state, we employ our nurses and the staff. WellPath is there to advise and help stabilize. They've been providing assistance to API to help with the stabilization and to help us meet all of the requirements through those findings that we had through our surveys.
So I can assume that they do not employ the psychiatrists as well?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank
the state
you,
employs those psychiatrists.
They do employ the psychiatrists?
The state, we
state.
Do.
State, okay, thanks.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
In the Department of Law, the Uktavik District Attorney's Office is being reopened. This is support from that community to help keep that office open. There's also some expansion of prosecutions in rural Alaska. This is a grant from the federal government, $250,000 in FY20.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As since it's in my district, one of the things I had was, isn't it true that the facilities or some of the entities that are up on the North Slope are also chipping in to try and make it so that reopening the offices doesn't cost the state as much as it would otherwise? Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, my understanding is this is an MOA that we're receiving money from that community to reopen the office.
And are they still doing cases there now, or are they all going back down through Fairbanks? Or don't you know?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't know the answer to that question.
If you can get back to the committee on that and then the sharing arrangement that is taking place. I think this subject matter was a point of discussion last year in the budget cycle, so we want to make sure it's well understood by all committee members. Senator Olson.
Are you planning to go to the next?
No.
First of all, going to the Department of Law, one of the things that's been hitting my office is the real concern that outside counsel has been hired by the Department of Law to go ahead and handle some of these cases that they claim they don't have any expertise, where in the tunes of hundreds of thousands of dollars for law firms in the lower 48. Is that reflected in this supplemental budget as well?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, what's reflected here is reopening of the district attorney's office, and the expansion of prosecutions is a new federal grant that the department's receiving. I believe those prosecutors are located in Anchorage but assigned to rural areas.
But the question has to do is this reflective of any amount of money that's being spent on outside counsel for some of these lawsuits that the population almost considers frivolous going out to there?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't believe so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We can, Senator Olson, we can flush that out in the subcommittee process. Also, we'll get to that answer. Okay, go ahead and continue.
In the Department of Natural Resources, there's $76,000 in receipt authority for aquatic farm application processing. There's been a significant increase in the number of aquatic farms, and so additional authority is needed for that processing.
So that's good in that we got an expanding industry, so that's a positive to help with that. I'd like the record to reflect that Senator Stevens has been here quite some time. He showed up when the aquatic center was under discussion. I think he has some of his rural kids in that facility also. So, Senator Bishop.
Mr. Steininger, this is just a small point, but do you think this is a direct reflective, maybe we missed it on the fiscal note when I think we passed some legislation in the last year or two to this topic, and we've just got more people applying, and that's a good thing.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I believe it went from 4 to 16 applications, so I'm not sure when exactly that was known, but it's It's a good thing, more businesses.
And we can also have the subcommittee drill into that and come back when they put their report to the full committee. We like positive news, so we'll take all we can get.
In the Department of Public Safety, more positive news. They've been able to see better recruitment and retention of troopers, and they're having the amount of people coming in from new trooper classes is exceeding the amount of people turning over within those ranks. So additional authority is needed in order to outfit those new troopers and pay those new trooper salaries. The aggregate of that across the several components with troopers is $6.7 million. There's also $105,000 for some new equipment on some of their aircraft that's required by the FAA for aircraft that goes into certain airspaces. And then $500,000 to replace older radios as well as bring in new radios for those new troopers.
Any questions on this? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad to see that public safety is a priority of this administration. So can I assume that a lack of request of funds for the operation of the VPSO program is a result of that program running at 100% and pumping on all cylinders, and people of Alaska in rural Alaska should feel very, very safe and sleep well at night?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, there's no request for additional money for the VPSO program, as the amount of money they have is sufficient for their operations in this year.
My question is, should people of rural Alaska, as a result of no additional funds being requested, feel that the program is running at full steam, pumping on all cylinders, and people in rural Alaska should feel safe at night? Yes or no?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I'd hope that the goal of the Department of Public Safety is that people in all regions of Alaska should be able to feel safe at night. So, yes.
We'll work on that issue in the subcommittee also. Senator Wilikowski.
How many VPSOs are there, and how many VPSO vacancies are there?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think I'd like to get back to you with that information. I don't have that off the top of my head.
Okay. If you can get back to the committee on the VPSO, that'll be also a fairly large issue for the subcommittee to be working on. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me, as a member of the VPSO working group, I'll fill you in on some of the answers that were questions by the people here on the committee. The VPSO program, first of all, is at an all-time low of 38 officers that are out there. There was anticipation a number of years ago when we had funded for 100 of those officers to be out there, but because of various circumstances, they've not been able to retain and recruit many of those people that we have. Now, I just happen to live in the town of Golovin, where we have a VPSO, and that person has been there the second longest of anybody around. The guy in White Mountain has been there for over 30 years, and so it's successful on those. But those are the only two success stories that we have. The VPSO program has need of an overhaul. A lot of it has to do with funding, or the lack of, not have to do with funding being allocated by the legislature or even by the feds, but it's a lack of funding to get out to where the rubber hits the road, and where these coordinators and these people that are contracted with the states have had such obstacles put into their way that it's been difficult. And so one of the recommendations by the working group is to pull that funding allocation out of the Department of Safety, Public Safety, and put it into another department that can more reasonably, according to the coordinators, more reasonably look at it and delegate those funds out there, and that'd be the Department of Commerce.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Olson, for those comments. And my question to the administration is, Has administration reviewed the report of the task force on the VPSO program, and is there interest in getting that report fully implemented so that people in rural Alaska can feel safe when they go to bed at night?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I think I'd like to get back to you on our analysis of that report.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, do you have a lifeline that could respond to that so that people in rural Alaska can get an answer?
We can facilitate that.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Tori Jacobson, Budget Manager, Department of Public Safety. Unfortunately, the commissioner is unable to attend at the moment. And unfortunately, I'm not able to speak to policy decisions within the department, but I will definitely research that and get back to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
you didn't even need to come up.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is brought in for Mr. Jacobson, is that there's a lot of money being put into trooper recruitment and retention. I'm assuming he's well aware of how much money's been spent to improve the recruitment and retention of VPSOs within his department.
Is that a question?
The question has to do with how much have they spent trying to improve the recruitment and retention within the VPSO program by the department.
If you can help them with that and then probably get back to the committee with a more refined answer along with the question from Senator Hoffman on the subject.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Olson, I think we'd like to get back to you with exactly how those, what funds have been allocated to recruitment and retention within the VPSO program. I don't think we'd have that allocation with us right now.
We can get that to the committee, and we'll get it to the subcommittee, and we'll also get it to the VPSO group working on that subject matter.
Mr. Chairman, if I could answer one other question by Senator Hoffman as to whether people should be sleeping better at night because they feel more secure in their communities, I can say that's an absolute no at this point.
That would be the answer I would expect, Senator Olson. Any other questions on this slide? Okay, next slide, please.
In the Department of Revenue, there's a fund source change for the tax revenue management system. There's a new system that was supported by a capital project. That capital project has been exhausted in FY20, and so that the cost of supporting that system needs to be moved into the operating budget. There's $350,000 for fiscal years 20 through 22 to bring on subject matter experts for economic and legal analysis on matters related to taxes. And in the commissioner's office, there's $104,000 for technology refreshes and space utilization in the state office building.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steininger, as you look at $350,000 in UGF, undesignated general funds, that's a fair amount of money. I guess what is going to be done within the next 5 months or 4 months once this thing is passed to go ahead and use up that amount of money?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the work on these matters will definitely be starting in fiscal year 20. This appropriation extends all the way into fiscal year 22. So the $350,000 won't all be spent in this year. This is to provide additional support as the Department of Revenue looks at various proposals that are out there related to taxation.
It's my understanding that there's a consideration of having a statewide sales tax issue that's brought up. Is that covered in this as well?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, this would cover looking at any type of tax proposed and proposed by anyone. It's to assist the economic research group in the Department of Revenue to give them the capacity to look at a lot of these issues.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
It just seems like this might be more appropriate in the FY21 budget. We'll work on that issue. Senator Bishop and then Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Senator Olson got the answer to my question. Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the expenditure being included as a supplemental to this year's budget, can this legislature anticipate any legislation while we're in session to address additional revenue measures?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I can't comment on any bills that haven't been introduced, but I do know there are various tax ideas are out there that they are wanting to review.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions on this? We'll have the next slide, please.
In the Department of Transportation, there's a technical fund source change to replace capital funding with unified carrier registration receipts in the measurement and standards section. This is a $90,000 fund source change. There's $7 million for marine highway vessel operations. This is to cover some additional costs related to, you know, some of the boats that ended up being in layup much longer than anticipated, and so more expensive boats had to be run on some routes. There's fuel cost increases drive this, as well as a handful of other smaller items that pushed up the operational costs. Is to ensure that the service level that was planned for this year is able to be met. In the capital section of the bill, there's $5 million for vessel overhauls. This is in addition to the amount already appropriated for that purpose in FY20. Some of the vessels, when they were brought in for overhaul, had much more significant damage to the vessel than was anticipated, and so the cost of those overhauls has been significantly more than what we projected. There's also $3.1 million in highway equipment working capital fund to allow DPS to access some of the credits that they've paid into that fund to purchase additional trooper vehicles for some of those new troopers coming on from those classes that we mentioned earlier. So there's an amount of money that the state equipment fleet can access every year to purchase new vehicles and to refresh old vehicles as they depreciate out. This is just increasing the amount that DPS has access to of money they've already paid into that fund.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Steininger, what would be the balance of that fund after this purchase, if approved?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I believe that the credits that the Department of Public Safety has in that fund are in the $12 million range. They pay in based on the vehicles that they have, so that fund balance, you know, is replenished every year, roughly equally, maybe a little bit more than they spend out on average.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at the highway, at the DOT supplemental budget that's needed in this, I wouldn't say not necessarily crisis, but it's quickly headed that direction. One of the questions I have is, any of this money going to be there to supplement some of the marine highway services that have been curtailed because of the maintenance issues that have there? For example, there's a number of legislative vehicles that are still stuck up there at the head of the that have been transported down and by the land carrier and are now waiting for the barges or for the ferries to go and pick them up that belong to a number of legislators and legislative staff that are there. How much of this money in the marine highway request is going to go into getting those vehicles up and running so we can get those vehicles down here?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the $5 million in overhaul is to try to get boats back in the water as they've been fixed. The $7 million really is to maintain the service level that was planned. There are a couple of routes where there will be, you know, that this $7 million is adding additional service over what was planned when the FY20 budget was passed, but that's not... It's not a significant portion of
I think what
the
we'll do on this subject matter, Senator Olson, rather than let the OMB director get warmed up in the hot seat, I think we'll have the commissioner of DOT come forward with a lifeline for him, because the significance of the economic impact of having virtually the entire fleet tied up for several weeks, I think we need to talk a little bit about that in this subject, in this request for informational flow to the public. So if we can have commissioners come forward. And he can bring a lifeline with him also. We have lots of lifelines today.
Thank you.
So I think the issue or the question that Senator Olson brought up is facilitating transport of vehicles in the fjord, Lynn Canal Fjord, down to Juneau. That's one, but there's a litany, and I thought maybe it'd be nice to have the commissioner kind of give the committee a quick update. And I'd like to ask the commissioner that we just put the sugar coating outside the door and we put this mess in the middle of the table and we're going to have to deal with it, so there's no use pretending it's not what it is.
Through the chair, for the record, John McKinnon, Commissioner of the Department of Transportation. I've got a lifeline with me, too. The first question, will any of this $7 million be used to add service? I think that was the question, add additional service. This covers expenses we've incurred this fiscal year that were unanticipated. Regarding stranded vehicles and passengers, when the Matanuska was tied up in Juneau and was unable to continue its run north, there were a number of military personnel and vehicles on board the ship, and we've arranged, or actually we helped the military arrange for transportation for many of those people, military heading to Haines and heading further up north. That has been taken care of. We also chartered Allen Marine, a local passenger service with catamarans, to take a number of stranded school kids that were on a basketball tour and other sport tours to get them back to Haines and Skagway. There are still a few people in Juneau trying to get out, and we understand there are a number of vehicles in Haines trying to get back down. We're right now in the process of deciding whether we actually make those arrangements. There are some union issues, union contract issues with this, whether we make the arrangements to get them from Haines to Juneau or other ports, or whether we facilitate that by providing information on where they can make the arrangements. And obviously, if they booked tickets and unable to make those voyages, those tickets will be refunded.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Commissioner McKinnon, thanks for coming up this afternoon, because you're the person that's kind of everybody looks to for answers, whether you like that or not. Sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. But right now, in this case, looking at some of the stranded vehicles, and Allen Marine, you made a good effort there, I thought, to go ahead and accommodate those people that are trying to get back and forth, because the students obviously have to get back and forth,
yes,
to continue on with their education. But what about the vehicles that are out there that are have been shipped down in good faith by legislative staff and legislators to go ahead and try and make sure that they have some type of transportation down here in Juneau during the time that they're visiting? I mean, are they going to, what do I tell them? To continue on renting your car? The car that's out there, or what kind of relief can we give them?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we were going to having those discussions today and tomorrow. Captain Falvey is in town. McLaren is in town. We're going to have those discussions today and tomorrow on what steps we take to make sure that those vehicles get transported to Juneau. Alaska Marine Lines does have weekly trips from Haines, Skagway to Juneau. That can be accommodated.
And one last question. Right. And that supplemental cost will be paid for by the state?
Well, you know, I think just like the Allen Marine costs, when we transported the students, we eat those costs. You know, again, we've got to be careful what kind of precedent we set in a situation like this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, how much costs have we eaten, as you just referenced? Or do you expect that we will in going forward in the next several months?
Repeat that question. I didn't quite hear.
Yeah, there was just a statement made that the Marine Highway had paid for the cost to have students transferred, and that those costs were eaten, was the word that was used. I'm just curious how much that is expected to be.
I think in answering that, if the commissioner can kind of give us one part of the answer in hindsight, and then kind of what the department's looking at in the future, especially over the next couple months, because we're going to quickly here be talking about the fleet capacity right now, because we're down to one ship that is actually in operation, is my understanding. But if you could kind of separate that and question.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I believe the cost of taking care of the stranded students was something on the order of $11,000. You know, they were basically, the education is largely state funded, ferry system is largely state funded. The choice was made that we would pay and take care of that, completing their trip. We are also looking ahead of what we need to do. There's a significant number of events that take place in March. There's a good likelihood from the press release yesterday that we will not have service in Southeast in March, and we're looking at what we can do in engaging other transportation services to take care of the transportation for gold medal tournament, for high school basketball tournaments, and other events that are occurring. It's not a situation that we're enjoying right now, but we've got a perfect storm where, for a variety of reasons, the vessels are either laid up in overhaul or unoperational, and we're trying to accommodate that. It's not the kind of situation like with aircraft or automobiles where there's a fleet sitting standing by that we can engage. There are a few available, and we've got the complication of, like I said earlier, union contracts that can prevent us from doing something or impede us from doing things. But we're working with the unions. They were very agreeable for the recent action we did getting the students back home, and they've been good to work with recently.
I'll be asking the Transportation Subcommittee, which Senator Bishop sits on, to look at the current budget and how much has been consumed in operations and the status of that, and then going forward, what it's going to take. Some of the broader concerns is when we have all vessels tied up except for one, the Latuya, going from Metlakatla to Ketchikan, which is our shortest run. We still have a substantial fixed cost coming in to facilitate or to impact the treasury. So even though no ships are running, doesn't mean the draw on the operating budget stops by any means. And I think the committee, subcommittee, needs to get a feel for that and be able to bring that information back to the full committee. The comment made by the commissioner, I think the public should take note of, in that there is a fairly high likelihood that there will be minimal or no service through March, and that they should, in planning, take that into account. And the hard dates of trying to get vessels out of the shipyard always seem to be a little more elastic than we'd all like, because once work begins, there's issues come up, and it's hard to hit those deadlines. So for the public, try to have a little flexibility as we work through this. Nobody likes the situation we're in, particularly coastal legislators, and I'm sure the Marine Highway doesn't find it very comfortable also, and the employees. So it doesn't look like there's any winners in this. It's a big mess with virtually the entire fleet secured to the docks in Ketchikan. So if you could, Mr. Commissioner, just kind of lay the Matanuska on the table and tell the committee what the issue is and why it's not running, and give us a little more information, because it's, I think the public needs to understand what we're dealing with, and we're responding to it. Is there a mechanical problem with the ship?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, was that a question?
Yes. How come the propeller doesn't go around, and how come it isn't running up and down the stairs?
Yeah, I'm a little hard of hearing. I might have missed that question.
Yeah.
You know, when we were putting together the operational plan for the vessels, it's kind of a complex thing of how many weeks of operation we can have. And a week of when a ship is operating, it's got a certain cost, including the fuel to run it around, but there's revenue associated with it. When a ship is through its mandatory annual overhaul, we program a certain amount of time for that, and there's costs associated with both operating and capital because it does take a certain amount of crew while it's in overhaul. And some longer-term savings, we put them in layup, and they're still, while they're in layup, it does take a certain amount of crew on there to operate the ship. So we program out vessels and their overhaul to keep their certificates up. And but when things come up, such as unanticipated additional steel replacement in a ship, and to a certain extent, we're a victim of technology because we've got non-destructive testing methods to tell us that the steel is either good or not good. And it may look good from the outside, but when you test it with the ultrasonic techniques, it turns out that it's not very good on the inside and needs replacing. So this year was one of those things where we anticipated a certain amount of work on some of the vessels, and when they were tested, the work was a lot more. And we planned vessel layups so that we'd have a virtually brand new ship in operation for the mainline haul and southeast in the winter. That brand new ship might have been 55 years old, the Matanuska, but it had it just underwent almost 2 years and $47 million worth of new engine replacement, and it was not the old part of the ship that broke down recently. It's the brand new parts of the ship, and very frustrating to us. There's going to be a lot of finger pointing that goes on as a result of this, but we had anticipated that a relatively new ship could handle the mainline service for the winter, or for much of the winter, and the new equipment failed us. So
we have a severe mechanical issue that makes the boat ship inoperable, and it's going to take a while to repair it, regardless of what finger's pointed where. With Senator Olson, did you have a question? And then Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner McKinnon, please express to Mrs. McKinnon that she is truly missed at this committee. But with that, it was reported in the news that by the governor that the marine highway system is a high priority of the administration. That was made yesterday. And my question to you is that statement, that profound statement by the governor, and a commitment to the people along the coast of Alaska, is that statement going to result in an additional supplemental to FY 2020, and will that also result in an additional supplemental request of the legislature in the FY 2021 budget? I don't know if he was able to communicate that to you, and maybe that answer will be forthcoming, but has that dialogue taken place between you and the governor?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that conversation is taking place. We're in the situation right now where we've got ships either in layup or overhaul, and we're looking at those ships. Which ones can we get out quicker? We're talking with the Coast Guard. The last ship to be in operation, mainliner, was the Malaspina, and the Columbia is in the yard in overhaul, and the Kennecott is in the yard in its annual overhaul, and the Malaspina was the last mainliner we had operating prior to the Matanuska being tied up. We're in conversation with the Coast Guard. Can we bring it back online? Similar cases with the Leconte and the Aurora. The Aurora has extensive amount of work to be done, but it was operating. And can we? And the Leconte is already under reconstruction. Can we get the Aurora and a temporary waiver to get it back online? We're looking at those things. When we know what we can do, we're able to do with the Coast Guard. We will certainly assess the finances of everything, and if we need more, certainly get back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think on that point, Senator Hoffman, I think the committee will be, subcommittee will be looking at the maintenance schedule. The concern is there hasn't been requests put forward to deal with these major maintenance items. And we are the appropriators. If we are aware of issues, it's easier to fund it versus unaware of it and having them tied to the dock. Also, the maintenance, the decomposition of steel ships don't happen in one summer. Or in the fall, they materialize over years, sometimes a few decades. So I'm a little bit curious on why all of a sudden everything piles up at once. So we'll have the subcommittee look at that, Senator Bishop, and also look at the certificates, why they're all seems to be too many expiring too close together, why these aren't spread out, and a few issues like that. And I'd also like the subcommittee to take a look at this particular issue and come back with a recommendation on what it would take to get this fleet back in operations. And I'm not talking about three stops a week for every town. I'm talking about service to our landlocked communities at most likely a reduced rate than 2-3 years ago. So don't misinterpret what I'm saying, but to have service, because we do have issues with our smaller communities dealing with basic things like food supply and our grocery stores and issues like that. So Senator Bishop, if you could help with some of those issues as we work forward, as I know you like to work a lot on the fleet numbers, so we'll throw that in your bucket also. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I did have one follow-up to Commissioner McKinnon. Good morning. It was my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's a warrantable item on the map that went down, correct? And so and the manufacturer is here with replacement parts, and they're making good on their commitment to follow the warranty. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senatorship, yes, it is warranty. But there's like any warranty issue, you've got the shipyard that installed the equipment, you've got a designer for the equipment, you've got the supplier for the equipment. There will be some finger pointing in there, no question about it. Fortunately, you know, it will take time to sort out, but in the meantime, we've got to get it fixed and up and running.
The finger shouldn't be pointed at this table, though.
Right.
We have funded the request for the Marine Highway. In fact, this committee overfunded the request in last year's budget of the Marine Highway by some 20-some million. And added back substantial millions in the Marine Highway funds for maintenance. And I'd also like to just point out before we run off to the next slide, there, just for those at home, there is no ships immediately in the STIP for replacement. And it's 8 to 10 years out. So to have new ships constructed, we got a long ways to go. There'll be forthcoming discussions on the Tuscumina and the replacement of that and where it is in the STIP. And I would expect there'll be some encouragement from this committee to get that ship moving along the way to replacement. But that has yet to be seen. We'll take that up in the when we get into the subcommittee budget process and at the full committee. I just thought I'd let the commissioner know that those discussions are forthcoming. We can't wait till all the ships are not only tied to the dock but sold in the scrapyard before we start figuring out what we're going to do. And I'd also like to remind the public that last time we had two ships built, which Tasleen and the Hubbard, came from the legislature in negotiations with the governor at the time for the appropriation that was driven out of the legislature to get those ships moving. So we've got quite the challenge in front of us, both the administration and the legislature, to try to figure out a transportation system that can function within coastal Alaska. And not to ignore the military impact that the Marine Highway has on concerning our bases in Fairbanks and Anchorage, and the ability of the Marine Highway, as referenced last year at this table, to respond in the event that we have some catastrophic event in mainland Alaska, the rail belt, to get emergency goods and services to the rail belt. Because we are under the standing an airlift would not work. So there is some concern that we're in a p- position today with our fleet tied to the dock and inoperable. And if we had a significant impact to the state, it would hinder our response, including an oil spill. So it's much broader than moving a car or a Alaskan from point A to point B. So we'll take up some of these issues and work with the department as we try to resolve them. Have any other questions for the Marine Highway? And again, for the public, please be cognizant that most likely it's going to be into April before the Marine Highway is back in some service. So plan accordingly and give yourself some flexibility, because as those dates become hardened and closer, we'll be letting the public know so they can anticipate that. And I do appreciate, before we get off this slide, do appreciate DOT's commitment to try to respond to facilitate some of the needs of the communities to get us through the next couple months, because nobody anticipated the entire fleet tied up once we didn't accept the proposed budget a year ago. Okay. We'll go on to slide 21, and we have slide 22. And we also want to come back to the real ID question that Senator Olson had on page 10. So maybe we'll do the next two slides, and then we'll back up to 10, if that's all right, Senator Olson. Okay.
Slide 21, there are fund capitalizations and transfers. There's a capitalization of the election fund, $3 million in federal receipts with 20% match from general fund. This matches to that Help America Vote Act capital projects I talked about earlier under the Office of the Governor. This is capitalization into the fund that that project is spending out of. There's also a transfer of $1.1 million out of the Alaska Housing Capital Corporation account into the general fund. Maintaining a small balance of that account requires a lot of accounting work and financial statements on that account, and so emptying out the last balance and putting it into the general fund will save some administrative work on the back end. Under special appropriations and capital items, we have judgment settlements and claims. There's one item there for $131,700. And then in the capital budget, you'll see a variety of repeals of older projects. So these are projects that have been completed and that there's some money left in those projects. It's about $5 million that's going to be deposited into the general fund from those older projects.
We haven't had that discussion here at the table on reappropriating funds from old projects, so stay tuned on that. You may or may not agree with the proposal. That is yet to be seen. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can the committee get a copy of the list of capital projects that are being eliminated and deposited into the general fund? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the projects are detailed in the bill as well as some backup documents, but we can provide those to you as well.
There was, right before we go backwards to finish up today and pick up the real ID issue, there's been a report put together on disposition of properties that the state may want to liquidate. Do you have any update on that? And if you don't, you can get back to the committee on those projects.
Chair Stedman, just a real brief update on that. There is the Facilities Council, which was facilitating the identification of various state facilities that are, you know, not being utilized or being underutilized that can be disposed of. And so there is a prioritized list that was generated as that activity.
Okay, we'll bring that back in a future hearing to take a look at those. One of them is the pool, Aquatic Center, Mount Edgecombe. We close it down, technically, I guess it's not used. So we're getting into kind of a circle there. I would suggest you review that particular item. And remember, in your review of the item, the public voted to build that facility. They didn't vote to sell it.
Chair Stimmen, that item was on initial drafts of that list, and I believe through discussions on what to do with the pool, it was removed.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that when we come into the presentation on that bond package. So that would be news to me if it was removed. I missed that. I hope that's in fact true. Which, and I will take it as the truth as you gave it to me. Senator Olson, you want to come back and deal with this real ID issue? Let's
no, I don't, Mr. Chair, not this time. I have a follow-up question for the, we'll deal with page 10 afterwards, but I have a follow-up question for what Senator Hoffman asked about some of the capital projects that have money that's going to be turned back into the general fund. You mentioned they were in the bill, and I'm sorry, I haven't been aware of that, but one quick question is the Connect Arm Bridge, one of those projects that's been, where the money's been put back?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't have the list in front of me. I'm not sure if that project is on the list. We worked with the departments that those projects were appropriated to ensure that, you know, they are truly complete projects and the funds being returned to the general fund are not needed for those projects. But the list is in the bill with specific, you know, locations and what projects
the project
they are.
Seems to be an albatross that's been hanging around our neck with at least a decade. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we'll go through that list, and there might be other issues or other projects, and we'll also have to have a discussion and a policy conclusion on what we want to do with that subject matter. Senator Von Imhoff is in charge of the capital budget, so reappropriations come under her preview, and she's not here today. So we will work on that in the future. We have other questions, concerns?
Chairman, I still would like to go back to the question for the administration and division of motor vehicles, if we could.
Sure, yes. And go ahead.
Whenever you're ready.
We're ready.
Do you have somebody else here that's you can get up to the seat beside you?
We can have you want a lifeline from?
Yes, please.
We have a commissioner here. She can come forward, introduce herself for the record, and help Senator Olson. I'll have Senator Olson state the question so it's clear to the public and the chairman what we're talking about, and we'll finish up the meeting in the next 9 minutes.
I'm Kelly Chivaka, the commissioner for the Department of Administration.
Senator Olson.
Commissioner Chivaka, thanks for coming out this afternoon. Thanks for coming to my office the other day to point out some of the alternative avenues that we can go ahead and get around this issue that's going to be affecting our people in rural Alaska. But the troubling thing that I have is that, as was pointed out by Senator Hoffman, is that you have a health, life, safety issue that's out there, and there is a $1.7 million request, but I don't understand what is the thinking, what's the mindset within the department or the division in particular as to their order of priorities, because there is no money request of the $1.7 million of UGF. There's no request to try and help with getting the real ID situation resolved out in rural Alaska.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Olson, for your question, because I appreciate the opportunity to address why we haven't requested funding for taking real ID out into rural communities, even though it is important to us that every Alaskan be able to get through TSA come October 1st. So I think it's very important that we clarify for all Alaskans that a real ID driver's license is not required to fly through TSA come October 1st. I think some of the messaging and some slogan campaigns has been misleading for Alaskans. So to repeat for everyone who's watching at home, you do not need a real ID driver's license to fly come October 1st. In fact, we have received an excerpt from the TSA standard operating procedures that show 30 alternative forms of identifications that Alaskans can use to fly come October 1st. Some of the more common forms of IDs that you can use are passports or passport cards, which are driver's license type size cards of a passport. A tribal ID that has a photo will suffice. A military ID, a Veterans Affairs ID, a prison ID, or a U.S. government ID, and the list goes on. Any one of those forms of identification will get you through TSA. What is required come October 1st is a TSA-compliant identification, not a real ID. The real ID paperwork burden is very high. You have to have a birth certificate, not a copy of it, an original birth certificate, or a passport. Well, if you have your passport, you can already get through TSA. So you don't have to wait in line or pay $40 for a real ID. Then you also have to have your original Social Security card, and you also have to have two forms of proof of residency within the last 90 days. We have found in some of our outreach efforts that this is a very high burden for urban Alaskans in addition to rural Alaskans, and the standard and expectation we're putting on Alaskans is high. We think that the real ID, putting it out there as a requirement and leading people to think that it is a requirement, is setting them up for a really high bar to pass. So we want to make clear it is not required to fly. In addition to that, many of these other forms of ID, like a tribal ID with a photo or a passport, are easier to pass that paperwork burden. We want everybody to choose for themselves what form of ID is best for you. We also have a statute that this legislature passed, so it's section 2815041 about real ID. What it says is that we cannot force anyone to have a real ID. In fact, applicants must clearly request a real ID in order to obtain it. The state can't require it, and local jurisdictions can't require it. So we're looking for an applicant to clearly request it for them to obtain it. And so we have 48 DMV locations around the state, including 17 in rural areas where applicants can come and request a driver's license. But I agree with you that we have some situations where we're going to have Alaskans who one of these alternative forms of ID isn't available to them, or they can't get it. And so the DMV has been going over and above the standard DMV operations to help out with this education and outreach effort. We've dedicated one of our staff members to doing outreach and education efforts, and we've been engaging with some of our rural points of contact and communities in a campaign that started under the last administration. And so we have some communications we've seen between that deputy commissioner and legislators saying we're doing a rural DMV on the go effort. It was going to require developing digital technology to take this very technical biometric identification camera out into rural communities, as well as other technology for signatures and identification screening. As long as we could develop that technology, we would go. And she communicated that this would end up with financial arrangements with those communities paying for the services, because every Alaskan pays for their services with the DMV. We have that going back from early 2018 that was being communicated with the legislature. I came in to the Department of Administration the last day of January 2019, and the program was continuing. We developed the technology in December of last year, so just a couple months ago, and we started piloting this. So we just want to see if it's going to work. So in engaging with a couple communities who've expressed interest and need, because that's our statutory requirement, they've said, we have some residents who have a need. Can you come out to us? So we went out to New Stewiehawk in January. We were able to issue 83 IDs to residents. So in that sense, it was a successful trip. But we also experienced significant challenges with the technical digitalization of that camera. And I am not confident that our rural trips are going to continue to be successful if we cannot solve the problems with the camera that has to meet these really high requirements for the biometric identifiers that are required under the TSA, the law that was passed for Real ID. We have five or so more communities that are on our list and ready to go, that we're working out the arrangements to go and pilot. We do not have more communities waiting in the wings that have asked for and are prepared. They have residents who said, we're ready to go. We want real ID. Can you come travel? But we are continuing to say, this is something that we're going to see if this works. And if it does work, then we're partnering with education, and we want to work with TSA to rebrand and educate Alaskans about what their options are. I did not
Let's stop here. We'll go clear till midnight. We have about two minutes before we run out of time. So, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We met with the commissioner yesterday with President and CEO Dan Winkleman from the Yukon Custom Health Corporation, which is the largest corporation in health corporation in the state of Alaska. That corporation covers some 56 communities spread out over an area larger than the state of Washington. And It was determined by Mr. Winkleman, and he stated that he believes that it's going to be the elderly that are going to be hurt the worst, and it's, although they may not have requested services, these are elderly people that English is their second language, and he said thousands of Alaska people that are elderly in the region are not going to be able to travel for health reasons. He stated that emphatically to the commissioner. Because the administration has not made, has not had the request, is an excuse that is unacceptable to this senator. And if you are having problems with your camera, you should be requesting additional services, revenue sources to address that problem. You should be requesting additional people to address the people that are unaware that their lives may be in danger. Lives may be in danger because you are waiting for them to request services that they are unaware that they need. That is emphatically uncalled for by your office, and I would say that if there are people that are lives are in danger, it is a result of your lack of coming forward and asking for resources of this committee, and I will be holding you accountable. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can I respond?
Sure. And then we're going to finish up the meeting because we're out of time.
Senator Hoffman, I don't make budget requests that aren't supported by data. There was a law passed in 2005 that said Real ID was coming into effect and there would be new requirements for passing through TSA checkpoints. So the United States has known for 15 years that this requirement was coming. DMV is contributing to the education of Alaskans, but we are not the only partners in the education of Alaskans about the requirements for getting through TSA checkpoints. Our responsibility is to issue licenses with respect to motor vehicles, and we're doing what we can to also help with the education of other alternative forms of IDs for getting through TSA. 543,000 Alaskans will have the potential of getting through TSA. 350,000 of them have passports, 65,000 have military IDs, 107,000 have real IDs. I don't know how many have tribal passport or tribal IDs. And we are open and available to discuss this possibility of doing a pilot, but I'm not going to bring forward a supplemental here when I don't have more than a handful more of communities that have requested us to come and help them with getting real ID.
Oh, I have a follow-up and then we're gonna...
Just a comment, do your homework.
Okay, so we will unfortunately conclude, not on a high note today. Normally we try to end the committees on some positive high note, but it's obviously a concern to some of the committee members, the ID, so we'll have to work on that going forward through the supplemental process and the budgetary process. I do appreciate the commissioner coming in and laying out the list of other IDs that will work to get through TSA. We, I think most of us knew a passport. It's nice to see that list, and we can try to get some of that information distributed out to the vast areas of the state to try to alleviate as much of the difficulty here as would be possible. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and thank everybody for coming. The OMB director and all his support lines, lifelines. We'll wait patiently for responses from DO, our OMB on the questions that the committee asked. And we'll be starting next week with the subcommittee process and start working through some of these problems. So that'll conclude the meeting today. Tomorrow, 9 a.m., House Bill 41, Shellfish Enhancement, will be up. Senator Von Imhoff will be back taking care of legislation. See everybody tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. We are adjourned.